My name is Judith Madison. I am on staff here this week, and I have been interested in Dorothy Day since I was in seminary, when I did a paper about her, and just read and read and read. There were so many books that she had put together. Sometimes they got overlapping, repetitious, but Dorothy's gift was writing, and she steadily along the way collected her writings, and many appeared in what was called the Catholic Worker, a paper that still exists today. And so we have the opportunity of reading a lot about her, and in that process I learned a lot about her, I guess. I titled this Spirituality, Simplicity, and Servanthood, and I think those things will show up as we hear her story. To begin with, Dorothy was born in 1897, and she died in 1980, so she lived, my memory is that they said she was 84 when she died. The numbers don't work, but whatever. And she was born in the Midwest. She lived during a good portion, not all the time, but she lived a good portion of her childhood in Chicago. And she would observe what was around her in Chicago. And of course, at that time, we had the meatpacking industry was very primary. And there was just a ton of poverty close to her neighborhood. Oh, hi. And for the tape listeners, that was a blackboard. That was a green board trying to fall over. So she watched in her neighborhood how it was and how some people didn't have enough. And it disturbed her. I would say the part about servanthood was a part of Dorothy from the time she was very small. She had mixed experiences. There's some folks wanting to come in if you want to. Mixed experiences with the church. Her family's relationship to the church was not very strong, but she had some friends who were involved in the churches. One was the Methodists, so she knew quite a few Methodists. If you know Methodists, any around, you want to claim for yourself?
Yeah, I grew up as one.
And Methodism often, just by the name, talks about ways of working for God, ways of acting in behalf of the kingdom, you might say. And so she was influenced by that, but she also was very drawn to a friend who was a Catholic, and to her family, and she would go over there. She's quite impressed by that. And she remembered walking in one day on one of the mothers of one of these friends, who found her kneeling on the floor praying during the middle of the day, and Dorothy just kind of never forgot those things. And it was sort of her responsibility to take care of her little brother, and she'd take him out in whatever that kind of buggy or stroller was, and walk around the neighborhoods. And she began to ponder what life was really supposed to mean. Now, her dad was a newspaper writer, so she was in a family that talked issues and was educated in that fashion, and she was trying to put together what she saw and what she heard and what she was supposed to do. What I did when I wrote this paper is took information and quotations together with poetry that I wrote. And so from time to time, what I'll be reading is a poem that capsulizes, I hope, some of what I learned. Hers was a call to write. Born a Christian in 1897, daughter of a newsman, devoted older sister, curious about the faith, she told stories about events and people. At 16, she walked the streets of the jungle, West Side Chicago, and came to know what it meant to be poor, oppressed, and powerless. She declared the church uncaring, self-concerned, disregarding the miseries of the world, waiting for afterlife. The church which she desired and nurtured lived a life now alien to hers. For many years, she consciously left it behind, which is in fact what she did do in her late teens and early 20s. And we'll get on to that in a little bit. I'll read to you some of the things that Dorothy said. I was tearing myself away from home, living my own life, and I had to choose the world to which I wanted to belong. I did not want to belong to the Upworth League, which some of my classmates joined. That's a Methodist Luther League, I suppose. As a little child, the happy peace of the Methodists who lived next door appealed to me deeply. Now that same happiness seemed to be a disregard of the misery of the world. Both Dostoevsky and Tolstoy made me cling to a faith in God, and yet I could not endure feeling an alien in it. I felt that my faith had nothing in common with that of the Christians around me. There are nowhere sufficient housing facilities right now, and I am writing in 1917. And when I read that, I think, oh, Dorothy. When I think of the human suffering, the amount, terrible amount of energy needed to move even infinitesimally toward a decent life, I'm amazed at human patience. Each of the radical groups had its own vision, and each was terrified that immediate gains would make the masses content and not willing to go further toward the new earth they were envisioning. Socialism was too doctrinaire. I could not understand Marx. The IWW had an immediate program for America, so I signed up with them. So she was like many people, this is right around World War I now, who were trying to figure out how to change the world. Who knows what the IWW is? International Workers
of the World.
So this was, in a sense, the beginning of labor unions, I suppose you could say. There was no attack on religion in her first newspaper job, she's talking about now, because people were generally indifferent to religion. Does that sound familiar? They were neither hot nor cold. They were the tepid, the materialistic, who hoped that by Sunday church going they would be taking care of the afterlife, if there were an afterlife. Meanwhile, they would get everything they could in this. So, we find Dorothy in the early, oh, in her early 20s and so on, pretty kind of cynical, and wanting something better, but certainly not trusting the church to be able to give that to her. And so she lived a kind of a, I can't think of the word. In New York, there's a section of town where people live who are in the arts. Yeah, she was kind, yes, exactly. Greenwich Village, Bohemia. Oh, I'll tell you, 6:15 at night, and she's all shut down. So, that's the kind of life she was leading. And yet, you know, she sometimes would, on her way home, she'd be up real late at night writing and partying and all this, and then on her way home, sometimes she would just drop by the Catholic Church and just linger there and pray there, and she just was continually drawn back to that life. She was married for a while. Well, she was in a common law marriage, and as she moved more and more toward Catholicism, it became a problem. She had a daughter, and the problem that arose between her and her partner was that she felt she needed to baptize that baby. And that's when she knew she had become a Catholic, and then she could no longer stay in the common law marriage either. But then she was caught between the fact that she now had given loyalty to the church, and it wasn't doing what she wanted it to do either. That was very frustrating to her. She one day had been at a great big rally in Washington, D.C., and had watched what she described as the ragged hordes of people who were in a march at that point for their own well-being. Now we're moving toward the end of the 20s and early 30s. And when she got home, she was just so, you know how you sometimes feel just so frustrated that you just don't know what you're going to do next? That was exactly the way she felt. And when she came home, here in her, what waiting for her was a man by the name of Peter Morin. I have his name here. Morin was a very idealistic man who believed that we could have a society that was completely different and non-materialistic and non-capitalistic. He said the first unit of society is the family. The family should look after its own, and in addition, as the early father said, every home should have a Christ room in it so that hospitality may be practiced. The coat that hangs in your closet belongs to the poor. If your brother is hungry, it's your responsibility. Morin, for example, hated the idea of hotels. He said, so hospitality, like everything else, has been commercialized. I've never thought of it that way. He believed in a green revolution, and so he started farms, utopian Christian communism. Think about how that all fits together. Private property with responsibility. It really does fit together. So hoe in hand between rows of beans, he lectured friends on his commutarian farms. So he established these, just remembering now, of course, New York City is not the city it is now, and so that you could have farms just on the outskirts of town. And so they did have that, and she, for a while, worked in some of those farms and so on. He was a man with a dream, and he needed a realist and someone to write his dream. And that's when he found Dorothy. We emphasize always the necessity of smallness. The ideal, of course, would be that each Christian, conscious, there's, by the way, the language in here is always wrong. It's always male gender language. And Dorothy never changed that, so we'll just do what she wrote. The ideal, of course, would be that each Christian, conscious of his duty in the lay apostolate, would take in one of the homeless as an honored guest. Imagine this for yourself now. Remembering Christ's words. The poor are more conscious of this obligation than those who are comfortably off. I know of any number of cases where families already overburdened and crowded have taken in orphaned children, homeless, aged, poor who were not members of their families, but who were akin to them because they were fellow sufferers in this disordered world. How many would agree and have observed that? And do we not hear from people that are afraid kind of to go and serve the poor? Maybe it's a meal or whatever. And then they find out that the people who are really warm and caring and inclusive often are the people who are poor. Now, I don't want to naively idealize that, but it is also true. Another one of Dorothy and Peter's sharp concerns was that there not be usury. We know the word usury? Meaning that we would borrow and take interest for our money. And they believed that was just dead wrong, biblically and otherwise, that no one should make money off money. Now, in the world we live in today, especially like these last 20 years, 15 years, this is, wow, that's a real blatant difference from the way we live. Time belongs to God, not bankers, not even 1%, said Dorothy. So this is a woman, I didn't put sacrifice up there, but maybe simplicity fits. She had some very clear ideas, and they were very restrictive in a sense. But through all that, she had this love for the people whom she didn't even know. Many times people who were hungry, who had no jobs. There was so much unemployment during a period of time there, as well as for people who were on the Bowery. She just ended up kind of down in that section of town often and could see how the misery of these people. And so she established a hospitality house. The poor came for hospitality. Who are the poor? The woman who sleeps with her husband on abandoned slum fire escapes until her baby is due. Then she comes to Dorothy. An alcoholic, released mental patient, distraught abused child, suicidal woman, all of them unmanageable, unwanted. They're sent to Dorothy. The poor are those with little to live for and less to eat. From Pittsburgh, Chicago, and right down the New York Street, the seamen on strike, the children of Harlem who have never before seen a farm. No questions asked at this house. No checkout time, no charge. Only kindness and the request to be fair and respectful of others. Hospitality. Dignity for the world's poor. Of course, people, when they found out about this, got excited to be able to send people to her, and so other parishes would do that. They would send their most difficult cases to Dorothy. Dorothy lived in a hospitality house, and that's where she worked on what was called the Catholic Worker, the newspaper. I thought for sure we'd have one here, and I just didn't see it. I may have missed it. But it's a very interesting little paper that comes.
I think it's in the resource room.
Yeah. Is it? Okay. It can be real radical sometimes. It's kind of fun to read.
Yeah.
And it's been produced since 1934, I think it is. And she would be busy doing that while all this hospitality was going on outside in the same building. She's raising her daughter all through all of this. And but she lived by the energy that she received from what was happening in this these encounters. She said there's always enough for one more. Everyone just take a little less. We kind of experience that at Holden Meals occasionally, don't we? I mean, don't you just watch how much you take because you can see how much there is for the table? That's all right. All we give is given to us to give. I love to see Catholic charity workers living among the poor in small places, in places so humble that the poor do not fear to come. Our poverty is not a stark and dreary poverty because we have the security which living together brings. But it is that living together that is often hard. Beds crowded together, much coming and going, people sleeping on the floor, no bathing facilities, only cold water. These are the hardships. Poverty means lack of paint. It means bed bugs, cockroaches, and rats, and the constant war against these. Poverty means body lice. Poverty means lack of soap and Lysol and cleansing powders. It's the living from day to day, taking no thought for the morrow, seeing Christ in all those who come to us, trying literally to follow the gospel that resulted in this work. What we pray for, we receive. Now, a person can't do what she was doing. Most of us can't anyway. Just on our own sheer will and energy. What was working for Dorothy was she had spiritual discipline, daily discipline. She read the Bible, she followed all kinds of devotionals, so that she had a pattern to her life that could sustain her. There's a book I noticed up in the bookstore about ritual. Yeah, it's by Robert Fulghum, I think, which should be interesting. But that's one of the things I'm thinking more and more about, is our need for ritual in such a chaotic kind of life that we live. It's dynamic, but it's also sort of all over the map, literally and figuratively. So to have some ritual is very important, and I think that's what Dorothy used to keep her going day in and day out. No one asked us to start an agency or an institution of any kind. In our responsibility, because we are our brother's keeper, if a man came in hungry, there was always something in the icebox. If he needed a bed and we were crowded, there was always a quarter around to buy a bed at the on the Bowery. If he needed clothes, there were our friends to be appealed to, after we had taken the extra coat out of the closet first, of course. It might be someone else's coat, but that was all right, too. I've never been able to quite forget that. And I live in Minnesota, you know, and I have more than a coat in the closet, coat for all those seasons. And it sort of stays with me. It's as if Dorothy is watching me. And she, you know, if you see the pictures of Dorothy, she just never smiled in these pictures, darn it. So stern always. She was a very serious person. We, of course, have ways of dealing with that kind of problem, don't we? Some of you may have heard Ingrid give matins the other day when she talked about when she gives anyone money on the street, someone who's homeless in particular, she first requires herself to meet that person, to be able to look that person in the eye and shake hands and ask how that person's day is and accept the same kind of question, and she would respond to them, so that it's more than a gift of money. It becomes a gift of person. And I thought about all the times I have averted my eyes from someone who's asking for money on the street. I notice my boys tend to give money more quickly than I do. That sort of interests me, that they do it that way. Of course, they don't give much to the church. If you're listening, I'm sorry. They're a little far away right now.
That erased the table.
Yeah, that's it. We'll erase that little piece of paper. Someone else did that once. But we find ways of rationalizing our way out of these kinds of needs in our society. Beware when things are going too smoothly, Father Lauerman said. That's the time when no progress is being made. And someone was critical of the work, and I'm sure she met this question many times. In fact, I think we meet it many times, and I think it's becoming kind of front page kind of question these days. Someone says, but won't people take advantage? And Dorothy said, of course. And don't we take advantage of God? Cannot we put up with others? Does not God put up with us? And then goes on to say that God is on the side of even the unworthy poor. As we know from the story that Jesus told of his father and the prodigal son. Charles Peguy, I think is how it's said, Peguy, I don't know, in God Speaks, has explained it perfectly. Readers may object that the prodigal son returned penitent to his father's house, but who knows? He might have gone out and squandered money the next Saturday night. Did you ever think about this? He might have refused to help with the farm work and asked to be sent to finish his education instead, thereby further incurring his brother's righteous wrath. And the war between the worker and the intellectual, or the conservative and the radical, would be on. Jesus has another answer to that one, to forgive one's brother 70 times 7. There are always answers, although they are not always calculated to soothe. We draw up our standards, measuring the worthiness of God's children based on our values of time, utility, productivity, gratitude, and return. Dorothy disagreed. In the face and hands and even the contempt of any person, she saw the opportunity to work for God. God's standards are not like our own. We realize when we calculate the worth of people, we become the poor. There was a man named Mark Ellis who wrote a book. He lived for a year at the Catholic Worker, and that's the title of the book, A Year at the Catholic Worker. A little book like this size. Lots of little vignettes of experiences. Now, Mark Ellis was a Jew, so he saw this differently, probably. But it is the most amazing story of what he learned in watching people, and how moved he was, and I think changed he was, by his experience of living at the Catholic Worker, volunteering, as it were, not unlike being at Holden, except not as comfortable. So Dorothy was realistic about what it was like to live in those settings, and she described these things for us. I explained that we're not a community of saints. Don't we tend to do that? We tend to sort of make saints. Isn't this a bad night? Deify is not the word I'm looking for. All right. People who are doing this good work, as if there's something miraculous about that person, then see, we don't have to claim that it's our responsibility too. We can just say, oh, they're so extremely special that of course they would do those things. And Dorothy says, I explained we're not a community of saints, but a rather slipshod group of individuals who were trying to work out certain principles, the chief of which was an analysis of man's freedom and what it implied. We could not put people out on the street, I said, because they acted irrationally and hatefully. We were trying to overcome hatred with love, to understand the forces that made them what they are, to learn something of their backgrounds, their education, to change them, if possible, from lions into lambs. It was a practice in loving, a learning to love, a paying the cost of love. And sometimes we probably all would benefit from just setting ourselves a goal like that and saying, now, this is going to be hard for me because I don't like going to nursing homes, or I don't like doing a particular kind of activity. I don't like getting dirty, whatever it is. We're all like that. And then, but setting a goal that's attainable without trying to be Mother Teresa. But Mother Teresa started with just small, ordinary things, you know, with people. And we could be like this, and that's what Dorothy, I think, is saying to us. People come to join us in our wonderful work. It all sounds very wonderful, but life itself is a haphazard, untidy, messy affair. Unless we can live simply, unquestioningly, and solitary, one might say, in the midst of a mob, then we cease to be a personalist. The more we live with people in a community, the more we must look to ourselves and regard the beam in our own eyes. When has that happened to us? When we learned more about ourselves because of the people who were around us. We thought we were going maybe even to teach or to help, and it all got turned around on us. Dorothy understood that. It was the community that was needed, a group of people who could spell one another and take turns coping with difficult situations. That's where I think we lose out so much in our society today. How much better we were talking earlier tonight, if a group of city churches would somehow find a way to work together and share the resources, not only financial, but share their staff, and share their goals and refine those goals so that they don't try to do everything. And then they have each other for support. And no one feels quite set adrift, as can often happen in urban parishes. Writing the Catholic Worker was squeezed in between fascists, upset people, establishing a house for girls, doling out clothes, getting funds. Yet the newspaper grew from a 2,500 circulation in 1934 to 100,000 in 1937. It is still published monthly today. So you might just see what that's like. And of course, the hospitality houses began to spring up, I suppose you might say, all over the country. Do any of you have a hospitality house or a Dorothy Day Center, they're often called now? Duluth, of course. Los Angeles, Minneapolis, St. Paul. I think Seattle has one. I wouldn't be surprised. Mm-hmm. Thing to live for. Some reason to believe that it could change. And it has, now of course it goes to many people. And wouldn't it be nice if we all got it in our own churches? So that it would be available for people to just leaf through. It's not a very expensive thing, I don't think. What's the kingdom anyway? What's Jesus talking about when Jesus is always talking about the kingdom? We don't take answers. You know, we don't make marks here.
His own gracious rule.
Okay. Did you hear right?
A realm which knows no geographic boundary, but reaches out to all and embraces all.
When is the kingdom going to come?
There's a sense that it's supposed to come in the future, but it's also a present reality too.
It's the not yet and the now, we often say. Mm-hmm. And I think Dorothy had a way of showing us that. And you remember I said to you that she was a pacifist in World War II, which I think was difficult to do. I would have difficulty doing that. She also was a person who allowed herself to go to prison when she was defending some women who she felt were being falsely or unnecessarily arrested. So what she did was, she was in solidarity with the poor, and she lived as the people around her lived. And that made it possible for her to be more than just someone who speaks about, like I do, about how we can be different and change and bring in the kingdom. We are fools for Christ's sake. We are weak. We are without honor. We are made as the refuse of this world, the offscouring of all, even until now. And following St. Paul, I'm certainly praying that we continue so, because this is needed. This is indeed the downward path which leads to salvation. The downward path. So now we have, that's what servanthood is about. And we always like to think it's going to be an upward path, but it isn't. And we see that so obviously in Jesus. It is the downward path that leads to salvation. If we had faith in what we were doing, making our protest against brutality and injustice, then we were indeed casting our seeds. And there was the promise of the harvest to come. Do you find it difficult for yourself to imagine harvest from small seeds? I was looking at a photograph in the newspaper tonight of, it's kind of like all of these talk show programs. Well, I mean, you know, like The Tonight Show and those programs. And the guest comes out or he tells a joke, someone tells a joke, and then everybody screams. And it's as if, notice me, here I am, you know, and they turn a camera on everybody, and that's what I saw in the paper. Everybody's waving to say, here I am, look at me. That's kind of the kind of society we've always been like that, but it's so blatant now, I think, compared to even 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago. And so it's that turning away from that, a desire to look successful and just staying faithful, which Dorothy offers to us as an example. That's that same thing about the downward climb or the downward move. I was idly saying my rosary, which was handy in my pocket. The recitation was more or less automatic. You know, I always discount that kind of recitation stuff. Then suddenly, like a bright light, like a joyful thought, the words, Our Father, pierced my heart. To all those who were about me, to all the passers-by, to the longshoremen, black and white, I was akin. For we were all children of a common Father, all creatures of one Creator. And Catholic or Protestant, Jew or Christian, communist or non-communist, we were bound together by this tie. We are all brothers. Whether or not a person lives in Jesus Christ, whether or not a person believes in God, the fact remains that we are all the children of one Father. The disciples didn't know our Lord on that weary walk to Emmaus until he sat down and ate with them. They knew him in the breaking of the bread. And how many loaves of bread are we breaking with our fellow are hungry fellows these days. Help us to do this work, and help us to know each other in the breaking of the bread. It was not required when you went to Hospitality House that you had to act Christian. None of this kind of gather around and sing the hymns before you get paid with your food kind of stuff, or you paid your dues in order to get your reward. She never operated that way. They did have Eucharist on a regular basis, but not daily. I think it was once a week. And no one was required to come. And some people never did, and some did. What would you say of the kingdom, Dorothy? That it means peace. And so we parade for peace and go to jail even in the 40s because we believe in peace. That when we give to the poor and stand with them and pray with them, for them, we have peace, even in the midst of putrid smells and crowded halls. The kingdom is not only to come, but it is to be here among us when we glimpse Christ in the tears of humiliation, he was humiliated, and the love of giving, he gave all. In the promise of freedom, he lifted the oppressed. We do not bring the kingdom, but find it along the streets and back alleys of cities and mines. We find the kingdom as we walk the way. As a last image that I'd like to leave with you is, for me, one of the most poignant ones that she wrote in her books. And I think it speaks to the dignity that she saw in every human being and that we lose sometimes track of. There's a man who walks about in the, I work at a church near the university. There's a man who walks about and his beard is very long. But you know, I don't believe he's very old. And he wears ugly old boots and wraps something around his legs in addition to whatever slacks or something he has on in a kind of a burlappy, heavy old coat. And he carries junk. You know, that's what we would say. Junk on his back. You've all seen a person like this. Dorothy always saw the dignity in that person. That she could always see his chin up. One day last summer, I saw a man sitting down by one of the piers, all alone. He sat on a log, and before him was a wooden box on which he had spread out on a paper his meager supper. He sat there and ate with some pretense of human dignity, and it was one of the saddest sights I have ever seen. That kind of image could stay with us as we travel away from Houlton someday. And that kind of inspiration that Dorothy gives us, I think, is a gift that I'm happy to share with you and you with others, I hope. And you may want to read about her or visit a Dorothy Day Center or however you are moved. Do you have questions?
I'm going to ask. Mentioned that she couldn't have
his child baptized. Oh, yeah, she did have it baptized. The choice she had to make was whether or not to become Catholic and have this child baptized or to stay in a common law marriage with the person that she loved. And she ultimately chose the church and left the relationship.
What's come of the daughter?
There's never much about her. Except that she did grow up and became a respectable person, but there's not much written about her. Oh, thanks.
What did you say?
I believe she lives in West Virginia. Either that or her daughter, or her granddaughter.
There was a great deal made of her communism for a while, and not very anything, ultimately, how does that fit in with her life? There was a period of time when she was great suspicion because of that.
Well, you know, in that period of time in her late teens and early 20s, when in her in her bohemian period, as we talk about, she is probably associated with a lot of communist people because she was looking for a way to help the poor from the beginning. So that could have come to haunt her in later years, especially, I suppose, in the 50s.
Yeah.
She never really was a communist. As she said in this, she didn't understand Marx. But she was looking for a way to help the workers. Yeah. Michael, you may have some comment on some of this. Are you aware of?
In this,
sorry.
No, please go ahead. So I've been using this book as a daily meditation this past winter.
That's a good idea.
And there's also an excellent little biography, about 3-page biography. And she was very, according to this, very popular, became very popular amongst Catholic people, and as evidenced in the circulation of the newspaper went up to 100,000 in 1937, and I think maybe if we could do some research, we might find that it dropped off at that period, because according to the biography, she opposed the church's view on the Spanish Civil War. I believe this church was a member, and she was not. And so people who could easily envision her as the saint helping the poor did not go along with her as a person who would have an opinion on her. Politics, or certainly an opinion of the church.
Most feminists would be very disappointed in Dorothy, because she just wasn't part of that whole movement. Comes out of that same period. I mean, I mentioned The Jungle, the book The Jungle, which was a product of what they called the muckrakers, when they started to write about and take issue with the treatment of workers in the early 1900s.
Maybe some people know about this woman in Minneapolis. Would you think Mary Jo Copeland, isn't that her name, could be a modern day Dorothy Day? I mean, she's done so much with rather little from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But hers is much more organized than Dorothy Day's in the past.
Hers grew out of a similar kind of resistance to the way things were being operated, too, in terms of the church's. She felt the church was being corrupt in the way it was trying to help the poor and so on. And so Mary Jo just went off on her own and started something called Caring and Sharing Hands. One of the differences would be that she really didn't live the simplicity life. Mary Jo doesn't. She's a very wealthy woman. But she absolutely does identify with those people for whom she cares. She's a marvelous person in that way.
I think that part of the Catholic worker emphasis was anarchy. I mean, not revolutionary kind of in the streets militarism by any means, but just this personal emphasis, you know, that really refused to get involved with big systems or institutions.
That's that Peter Morin piece where he came in and said that he really was an individualized, and he did not like, he was mistrustful of all those forms of government. That's why she lists fascism as one of, you know, fascists are coming through.
Judith, I'm struck by your comment about looking at the newspaper and seeing everybody kind of grabbing for attention. You know, my experience is just with my own journey as well, that you know, just learning our own acceptability before God is such a key part of that. And it feels like there are so many folk out there that don't even understand, I mean, even within the church, fully understanding their worthiness. And so it feels like even a critical issue, even within the church, because then that's the attention seeking or the you know, the need for approval or whatever. And that just feels, I don't know, just when you said that, it's just really weighing on my heart, just how much that is still an issue for so many folk.
And I think it begs the question of, why is it that when we have this gospel, and we use the word grace all the time, and maybe we don't use the word worthiness and value, maybe we don't use that kind of language. Why is it not getting through to people? Is it that we don't tell it? Or is it that we're using the language that no longer means anything to people because it's become institutionalized language? Or is it because we haven't met them one-to-one, which is what Dorothy was doing, one at a time? which is the way Mother Teresa started to, one at a time. And that's where I think John's idea of using a book like this on a daily basis, that would be a ritual, a discipline for us, a way of approaching the rest of our life for a while. And it might help anchor us a little bit, keep us in a direction. Because we don't, are you like me? You get kind of fragmented in your thinking and doing. It's hard to concentrate.
A big part of it.
Yeah, getting along. You know, community is not as ideal as it sounds. You've probably figured that out. And isn't that true with our liturgy in a sense, too? Sometimes we drift in and out, but it's always there for us. And the example I like to use most is when my son was, I just discovered my son was very ill. He's fine now, but at that point he had cancer. And that next Sunday, and I went to worship, I was leading worship, of course, and it happened that I had to make an announcement at all, I was in a church, we had four services, and I had to make an announcement at all four services, so every service I had to then do the creed. I was standing there doing that creed, and kind of was the only thing that got me through. Yeah, I knew it, you know, I don't know how much I believed it or how much I could really emotionally absorb it, but it was something that gave me stability. It was predictable. I'd heard it before, and I could hear all those voices out there saying it, giving me support. Again, it speaks in favor of ritual and community. Just since some of you came late, let me just show you that the bookstore does have these four books. The Long Loneliness. Dorothy Day, A Radical Devotion by Robert Coles. Dorothy Day, Selected Writings by Robert Ellsberg. And then Love is the Measure, which is a biography by Jim Forrest. And there are several copies of the different ones. Good, I'm glad we had this chance to be together. You can turn off the tape. This week I will be doing classes on energy and our limits. That is, not this kind of energy, that kind of energy. And probably Life is Good, Life is Hard, and something on transitions. How do we kind of cope with transition? And a group on Elie Wiesel. That'll be a two-parter, but you can come to one or the other. I have great respect and love for Elie Wiesel, and so I'd like to present that too. So we can go to Vespers, which is our ritual for today.